This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. Hello, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, and I have another special guest in the studio. I know I say that all the time, but I just happen to know a lot of really awesome people. But before I start in with my guest, I wanted to read you a quote from a book we're going to be discussing today. It's by Leslie Apold, and it's Runaway Inequality. There's nothing in the economic universe that will automatically rescue us from runaway inequality. There's no pendulum, no invisible political force that will naturally swing back towards economic fairness. Climate change is not going to heal itself. Either we wage a large-scale battle for economic, social, and environmental justice, or we will witness the continued deterioration of the world we inhabit. The arc of capitalism does not bend towards justice. We must bend it. And that was from Leslie Apold. Now, I personally believe we must smash it, set it on fire, and make soap to cleanse away all of the taint of capitalism. But, you know. But I wanted to introduce who I have in my studio today. He's another great activist. His name is Brandon Castro. Welcome onto the show today,
Thank
Brandon.
You for having me, Heather. Great. It's a high praise coming from you, so thank you very much.
So, Brandon, you work at New Jersey Work Environmental Council.
Yep, the Work Environment Council.
And what kind? I know there's a bunch of different campaigns that they run there. Can you give me an overview of what kinds of campaigns they run?
Yeah, sure. So the Work Environment Council is an alliance of over 70 different organizations that fight for safe, secure jobs and a healthy, sustainable environment. The important thing here is to note that these two things are linked, right? So a lot of the times what we see when groups come together and fight for their dignity and their rights, that there's lots of conflict. Sometimes labor unions butt heads with environmentalists, and sometimes different activists butt heads with each other on a whole lot of different issues. And the Work Environment Council was kind of founded on the basic principle that we all have a shared common interest, right? Worker justice is climate justice, is environmental justice, is ecological justice, is health and safety, is higher wages, paid sick time. All these things are linked. They're one fight. Sometimes we don't always see that. And we have campaigns that are focused around bringing those issues together, bringing communities and workers together. So, for example, we run a Healthy Schools Now campaign. This campaign is focused on getting healthy schools, not just for safer working conditions for teachers, but also because our students learn in those environments, right? We have another campaign. We've long done trainings based on occupational health and safety. Now we do chemical safety trainings for both workers and management, right, in order to get those systemic changes in workplaces that see, you know, more dignity and safer working conditions for all workers.
And there's also an environmental campaign as well, right? Jersey Renews campaign, and is another one that you've brought on fairly recently.
Yeah, Jersey Renews is a campaign that we have. And Jersey Renews is brilliant because it's an environmental campaign that starts with labor, right? So, you know, our great organizers, Dan Fatton, who's our executive director, and Nora Langweiler, who's the organizer on the project, went to a lot of labor unions, and they started an environmental campaign and developed a platform for environmental justice that starts with labor unions. It can be a very difficult thing to get everybody in a room to agree on, but they went out there and they did it, and I'm always in awe of that.
But your specific campaign you work on, which is also the one that I've been involved in, is the Public Need Over Corporate Greed campaign. Mm-hmm. So do you want to give me a general overview of that, what that is, and then we'll get into all the specifics of it?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I had mentioned before that WEC very much focuses on, we focus on how all struggles are one struggle, right? And if that's true, then there must be sort of some kind of common opposition, somebody that benefits when we're all divided. And, you know, there's been a lot of excitement and talk recently with the, you know, presidential primaries and in the mainstream media now about income inequality. This is an issue that's bubbling to the forefront, right? And Les Leopold, who's the author of Runaway Inequality, has long been an ally of the Work Environment Council. He's from the Labor Institute, and he's done a lot of really great labor organizing over the course of his life. So when he wrote this book, which sort of traces how the ultra-rich have sort of risen to power in a more extreme way over the past 40 years, it almost seemed like a natural fit, right? So here's an organization that focuses on crossing all these wires and finding our common obstacles. and going on the attack. And here's this book and this activist who has long been an ally who is working on the same thing. And so Public Need Over Corporate Greed is our campaign that we have in New Jersey in partnership with Less's National Runaway Inequality.
And so the main topic of, you know, what, you know, there's trainings throughout the state that we can get into a little bit later, how to sign up for those. But the main meat of the issue is financialization.
Yes.
And how that has been strip mining our economy.
Right.
And taking the money out of all of our working people's pockets to put it into
right.
the pockets of a very specific elite group that are hoarding massive amounts of wealth. So can you tell me what financialization is exactly?
Sure. So I think, first off, what I want to do is clarify when, you know, when we say strip mining from our economy, right? The financial sector has been strip mining resources from our economy. We have to stop and consider what that means, what we mean when we say our economy, right? Because you can hear that the stock market is doing excellent one day and terrible the next day, and that might not mean a thing to many working people out there, right? Or it might mean something in terms of our retirement fund if we're lucky enough to have one of those, but that's a long way off, right? And the amount we're benefiting from that is insignificant. So when we talk about our economy, we're talking about our communities, we're talking about money for you know, public services, we're talking about our ability to build sustainable communities, municipalities, counties, and states, right? And so I'm sorry, I kind of talked myself into a corner here.
The question was, we were talking about what is financialization.
Right, what is financialization?
This strip mining that's happening is mainly based off of financialization. So what exactly is that?
So distilled into a simple definition, financialization is the growth and power, growth in size, power, and command over our economy of the financial sector of our economy versus other sectors.
And that being Wall Street and the large banks.
Right. So when you refer to the financial sector in the United States, we refer to our Wall Street type operation. And this growth has happened since the 1970s. And I guess we'll probably get into that a little bit. But what's important to note is that as this is happening in the United States, that power and influence has expanded outward. The United States is already an enormously influential economic actor on the world stage, an enormously influential, some would argue imperialistic, military force on the world stage, right? And so when these, we'll call them financial strip miners, when these sort of crooks on Wall Street start taking money out of our economy, you start to see the way they start taking money out of other economies as well. So it's not just confined to the United States, it's a global phenomenon.
So it used to be some time ago, you know, up until, you know, maybe the late 60s, early 70s, as worker productivity, because workers are constantly producing more and more and more, then their wages were rising along with that productivity. And then something happened in the early 70s that kind of separated those two things, that was believed that they would be together forever, but something actually broke them apart. And that's kind of where financialization starts taking over. What was it that happened in the early 70s?
Yeah, that's correct. So that's interesting to actually elaborate on that a little bit. When you take a look at that graph, and I'm sure a lot of listeners might have seen that graph before, but you see this line go up and up and up, and it's productivity, and you see these two lines, the other line being wages, split apart. Realistically, what that means is that our wages should be, on average, double what they currently are. We should have double the buying power of what we currently have. Or we should be working half the amount of hours that we're currently working for the same buying power. Which is an interesting thing to consider. How and why did it start in the 1970s? That's the interesting story, right? Because in the 1970s, some listeners might remember it, I don't, unfortunately, I wasn't around. We had a very tumultuous time in the United States in terms of our economy. Stagflation was not fun for a lot of people, nor were the oil boycotts. None of this was fun, right? So people were mad, they were upset, and they were ready to sort of blame the social and economic upheaval that was taking place in the 60s and the early 70s, right? And so I don't want to sort of get too much into this, but because you can really go down a rabbit hole here, but the ultra-rich organized, and they organized hard. There's a really interesting guy named Lewis Powell. He was a Supreme Court justice, and he wrote a manifesto. It's called the Powell Memo. It's very famous. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is the kind of thing you can go up on Wikipedia, and it's right there. And he outlines exactly what the plan was for large corporations and the financial elite to take control of our economy and our social systems back from working people, from activists, from, you know, what they identified as, you know, hippies and subversive elements and anarchists and socialists. When, at the time in the 60s and 70s, yeah, a lot of, you know, radical folks were organizers, but working people all across the country of perfectly reasonable and moderate beliefs had a problem with the system we had, and they wanted to build something better. And this was something Lewis Powell sort of got a bunch of his corporate cronies together, and they organized hard.
And people were coming together and building power, and that would have taken power away from these corporations. So they fought back actively mm-hmm. as a unified voice, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I highly recommend going out there and reading the Powell memo, because you'll see everything that they outlined in this manifesto has come to pass.
He pulls no strings. He pulls no punches. He doesn't lie about what they're trying to accomplish. It's their clear as day what they wanted to accomplish and how they were going to accomplish it. It's conspiratorial because there's literally a conspiracy, but it's the easiest thing to dig up. It's right.
Right. It's not
the
a conspiracy theory. It's yeah. not like aliens are involved. This is right. There's actual yeah. documents you can read right. to see the
and evidence and people acting on this. This is what I mean. This is what our modern television news stations are. They are the fallout from this. It's the decision that you can talk about this and you can talk about this, and we'll have the, you know, the left wing news station that talks about this and the right wing news station talks about this, but there's certain things that are going to be off limits. We're not going to talk about the wars too often, at least not in a negative light. We're not going to talk about the details of financialization and how that happens. We're going to stick to talking points, stick to social divisions. You know, these things are all the sort of the legacy of the Powell memo, and it's super interesting to read about.
And now the other part of that was, part of this plan was we had to deregulate. There were lots of regulations that were put on the financial industry after the Great Depression.
Sure.
So that, you know, the Great Depression didn't happen again. So part of their idea was deregulating Wall Street and opening mm-hmm. up some new unscrupulous methods of handling money. Can you go into a little bit about the Better Business Climate model and yeah, sure. that deregulation?
So yeah, so these days a lot of folks and academics call it neoliberalism, but at the time they just called it the better business climate model. And the idea was that if you cut taxes, you cut regulations, and the biggest regulation on corporations, of course, is unions, so they went on the attack on unions, you increase privatization, then you'll see an increase in investments and competition, and all boats will rise. This was the sort of idea they put out there.
And both parties were putting this idea out there. It wasn't specifically...
It started with the Republican Party, but they were so successful with it that the Democratic Party, which had its own complicated internal politics, ultimately went along with it too to keep winning votes and elections. But it started very much with the Nixon administration and was really accelerated by the Reagan administration. But what they did when they cut those regulations, they went on the attack on unions. But another important thing they did was they deregulated the financial sector, right? It wasn't just, there were actually a few new environmental regulations that came out in the late 70s after these people took power. Shockingly, it always
shocked
everybody.
Yeah, the Clean Water Act actually, I believe, came out of Nixon's administration.
Yeah, yeah, that Nixon was a little bit of a conservationist, and this stuff is all very interesting. But what Nixon and Reagan both worked to do was cut regulations in the financial sector specifically. There were a couple regulations that really had a big impact. The first was actually a tax regulation. It was an SEC. It was cutting capital gains, the capital gains tax. This is a big thing we talk about now. And that statement, that conversation got very wonky in depth. But basically, this made hedge fund and private equity activity extremely profitable. Back then, they would have called those folks corporate raiders. And what these organizations would do is they would go around and they would buy up company after company using borrowed money. Typical system, right? Seems all fair and square. You take out a loan from a bank. You're a hedge fund manager. You take out a loan from a bank. You use that loan to buy back the company, right? And typically, a normal person, a small business owner, or somebody renting out a car or leasing a car or something, absorbs all the risk of their loan, right? That wasn't what happened here. Hedge funds would take out this loan from a big bank. They would buy a company. And then they would make the company pay the whole loan back. not a dime would come out of their pockets for paying back their own loan.
So they're gambling with other people's money. It basically is what could have been a successful corporation now has a massive debt because somebody else bought it.
Well, they're also incentivized to keep wages down, right? Because if you're paying your workers more, you might see more long-term gains. Your workers might be happier, more productive, might make better products, feel like they have ownership over part of the company. You're getting paid more, right? And so you have a healthier company that lasts longer and generates more profit in the long term. But your goal is to pay back that loan. The interesting thing, too, is that they always take back out a bigger loan than they need to buy the company. They take a premium right off the top.
Right, they pay themselves for having this brilliant idea of buying this company and saddling it with debt.
For completing the transaction.
Yes.
It's their reward fee. The other regulation they took down, and this is really interesting, is an SEC regulation, 10b-18. For years in this country, it was considered illegal stock manipulation for a company to buy its own stocks. The corporate entity itself, the company itself, buys its own stocks. This was considered illegal stock manipulation. It was manipulating the value of the stock, and it was illegal. Well, around 1982, they decided to get rid of that regulation. It's still illegal to buy back stock something after, like, 8 p.m. on a Sunday or something like that.
It's very specific.
Yeah, there's, like, a very specific time of day you can't do stock buybacks. It doesn't make much sense at all. But now companies can buy back their own stock. So think about it. Heather, if you and I each own a share of a corporation, and that share is worth... I know you've done this exercise before, but just for the listeners, that share is worth $500,000, right? So I have a share, you have a share, and it's a $1 million corporation. I buy back your share and retire it. How much is my share worth?
Now your share is worth $1 million.
My share is worth
$1 million. You've doubled your share value.
Right, and when a CEO is paid primarily in stock incentives instead of an actual fixed salary, or at the end of the year you get a raise, you don't get a raise, et cetera, et cetera. Their salary might be something like $200,000, $400,000. And through stock incentives, they're collecting $30 million a year, $20 million a year.
So their incentive is to artificially pump up the price of a stock.
And the result is the incredible depressing of wages that we've seen since the late 1970s, right? Because the sole goal for the sole incentive for the CEO is to buy back those stocks. Not pay people more, not raise wages, not create better products. It's to earn profits quickly, to buy back stocks quickly. You do that by cutting divisions, cutting people's wages, depressing people's wages, all sorts of nefarious activities. The actual hard result, we drop this number all the time, in the 1970s, the income gap between the average worker, average non-supervisory worker, that's the majority of the workforce, and one of the top 100 CEOs was about 45-1, meaning for every hour you worked in the 1970s, if you made a dollar, they made $45. Seems like a lot. Today, or rather, I believe in 2016 was the what we had the numbers for. In 2016, it was 844-1. For every dollar an hour the average non-supervisory worker made, one of the top 100 CEOs made $844.
Yeah, and I don't think people realize quite how drastic that difference is. Mm-hmm. Most people may actually still be thinking it's somewhere around what it was before, then in the 40-1 range.
So this is interesting, is that you talked a little bit about, we do trainings and we do education based on this, and most people guess that if they're very, very cynical, they throw out a very high number. They might say like 1,000-1. But for the most part, people usually guess about 100-1. Most people think in the United States are under the impression that's about 100-1. And they think that's too high. Most people in the United States, Republicans included, think it should be around 7-1. Right? So
844-1 versus 7-1 is drastically different. It's not even the same ballpark.
It's not even the same ballpark. And what is interesting is it shows that we all want similar things, right? Which is an interesting issue. Politically right now, it feels like we're all talking past each other, which makes sense because these are issues that affect people's lives. But when you really put it that way, you realize, what are people's interests? People's interests are supporting themselves and their family. That's their primary interest. That's their first interest. We all want the same thing in regards to that, right? We have different ideas about how to get there. Some of our ideas about how to get there are appalling, or ideas that we can't even stomach, right? But it's shocking to see how much we all kind of want the same thing.
Right. And now there's some modern examples of this that are happening right now in our society that we're seeing play out. For example, Toys R Us would be an example of this, how this company was saddled with a huge amount of debt and was forced to sell off their web sales.
Yeah. So this is interesting. So Toys R Us is actually, it's a private company, so there were no stock buybacks at Toys R Us. It's not publicly held. But Toys R Us was owned by a private equity firm, and private equity firms do the same thing. They depress wages, and they for the sole purpose of paying off corporate debt, right? They saddle a company with tons of debt and a little sliver of equity. One of the most famous examples of this, and one of the first examples of this, was in the 1970s. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but super wealthy guy. He famously bought out the largest greetings card company in the United States, right? Or one of the largest greeting card companies in the United States. About $1 million of it was his own equity. About a couple, I think 20 more million was debt, right? So he bought it with about $20 million in debt.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. And then the company automatically had that debt on top of it. So it couldn't, you know, when they say, oh, we can't afford to pay you anymore, they're not exactly lying, because the company saddled with this huge amount of debt. So that's where most of the, you know, even a successful company's resources are going. And also recently, I guess we should talk about stock buybacks and how with the tax cut that just happened, the Trump tax cut, the huge amount of that that's going towards stock buybacks. Yeah. They said, oh, this is going to stimulate the economy. Yeah. But
And the math with this is very simple. Walmart a couple years ago did about $20 billion worth of stock buybacks in a single year. They do this every year. $20 billion, you crunch the math, real simple, divide it up amongst the amount of non-supervisory workers in the U.S. that Walmart employs, and that's about a $600 raise per paycheck for every single one of those workers.
Wow. That's...
So when we say that people's wages should be double, people's purchasing power should be double what it currently is, that's where the money is.
And that money is going to the shareholders. It's going to the CEOs, when it should be going to the people working in these organizations.
Absolutely, yep.
That are creating the value.
And for, you know what, for a long time, there was CEOs and the financial class in the United States was under serious threat, because even business owners, what, you know, people might call the capitalist class, or the people who are, you know, sort of on top of the ladder, we're starting to realize that good organizational culture, building a good, successful business in the long term, actually meant doing the right thing by your workers. There were lots of interesting experiments that were showing this. GM New Me is one of the famous labor experiments, where we adopted a different kind of more social organizational culture, and GM saw a huge uptick in productivity at that plant, and the quality of the products they were making, right? And so the creeping reality of how a business actually should be run, which is probably a lot more cooperatively than it is now, that was creeping up on CEOs and on investors, right? The fact that if we want to run this company well, if we actually want to compete, we might have to give up some of our wealth, right? And so that just
couldn't be tolerated.
Yeah, that could not be tolerated, right? So that's one of the big driving factors behind that sort of the political revolution of the ultra rich in the late 70s and early 80s.
So I think we've depressed the listeners pretty well here with hearing all of these statistics and stuff, which happens. But that's where these trainings that New Jersey WEC offers comes in. You actually train people on how to go out into public and then train others on this. Mm-hmm. The goal is really a mass education movement.
Absolutely.
So can you tell me a little bit about the trainings and how people can get involved with those?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, this is very much born out of both our own work at WEC, doing trainings for a long time on very, like, hard practical issues like occupational safety and health, chemical hazards, that sort of thing. And Les, who, you know, has been working in the field of labor for a long time, doing popular education, which is education that sort of comes from the people, right? And so for us, these issues are enormously complicated. It's very easy for a Donald Trump to come along, or any kind of demagogue to come along and say, you know, who's our enemy? Who's stealing all this money from our economy? It must be undocumented immigrants. It must be lazy people in communities of color who can't find work. It must be, you know, XYZ demographic of, you know, it's a large demographic of working people. And then it's very easy for the news media on the left to sort of get lost in that messaging and sort of fail to accurately counter it or educate people otherwise, right? Telling people that a system that enriches 1% of people is actually responsible for all this money sort of drying up and not existing inside of our economy, that's a much harder pull. Right, you have to have a long face-to-face conversation with somebody. You have to have an educational initiative, right? You have to have an educational infrastructure in order to do that and change that messaging. And so that's what we want to do. We sit down with people for 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, and we do a full-blown training where we talk about economics, and we talk about the social conditions that led to the economics, and then we ask our audience, what kind of economy do they want to see? What kind of world do they want to create? By the end, we find that most people kind of want the same thing, right? We all kind of want the same thing. There's a lot of power in that. So the way we do this is we do train the trainers, right? So we take activists from all different kinds of groups, everybody from green activists and environmental activists to folks in labor unions. We try to and faith leaders, and we try to get folks in the same room together talking, right? And sort of educating themselves as trainers so that they can go and bring it back to their constituency and deliver that to their constituency in the way that's most relevant for that group, right? Because every group is affected differently by this. Communities of color are affected by financial strip mining in different ways than the middle classes, right? Poor communities of color, rather, in different ways than the suburban middle classes, right? And so noting that and working with different partners across silos, but then getting them all in the room together, that's extremely important for us.
And so how many trainings have you done so far?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So the amount of trainings we've done so far, I couldn't list off the top of my head. We've trained about 75 trainers, and we've trained just over 1,000 people. That's over about a year and a half. We're sort of ramping up. In 2018 alone, we've trained about 350 people.
Wow, that's good. But yeah, we still need to reach so many more people campaign.
Right, so I mean, we need to reach thousands of people, right? We're basing our model off of what the populace did in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. These were the movements that eventually would win the New Deal, right? Or created the language that made way for the movements that won the New Deal in the United States. That's the kind of thing that we want to push for, we really want to accomplish. And we can't do that any other way than the sort of hard slog of education. We have to reach out and have face-to-face conversations with as many people as possible in order to change the narrative and build a movement.
So people have options that if they just wanted to schedule the more basic level training, you know, the somewhere in the 2 to 4 hour training, that's an option. And then there's these intensives where you actually train people, new trainers, to go out and become trainers and do those trainings themselves.
So if you're interested in bringing a training like this to your organization, there's a couple options. We do the train the trainers. We have one coming up at the end of this month. It's May 31st and June 1st will be our next train the trainer. Train the trainers are full day because that's the intensive class. That's where you get everything, right? And then we kind of throw you in the deep end to learn how to do it, and then you can take it out to your members. Alternatively, I would encourage people to get in touch with me. Like I said, we have 75 trainers across tons of different kinds of activism across every region of the state, right? And so I would be happy to coordinate that and put you in touch with somebody in your area or in your field of work that can come and consult and maybe do a training with you. I would encourage people to, on that front, visit our website, www.njwec.org. Under campaigns, you should see Public Need over Corporate Greed. That little page will have all the information you need. It has my contact info plus the application to be a trainer. On top of that, anybody can feel free to contact me. My email is bcastro@njwec.org.
All right. I'm also one of the trainers. I've done quite a few trainings in
area. I didn't know if that shattered your impartial.
I'm not impartial.
My interviewer.
I'm working for an anti-capitalist news station. Right, nobody thinks I'm impartial.
Sure.
But also, you know, if you wanted to specifically get a training, if you're in the South Jersey, Atlantic County area, you can always reach out to info@NewJerseyRevolutionRadio to find out how you can get me as a trainer. But I recommend as many people take this train the trainer as possible, because we need this movement to grow exponentially.
Sure. I think one more thing I'll say about it is, I'd mentioned this before, an important thing to consider is that there's a lot of talking past each other. Both, I guess, on the left you know, us kooky folks on the left, and then also in the broader American conversation. We sort of use talking points at one another. We know what team we're on. We know how we feel about these issues, right? And a lot of it really gets tied very closely to electoral politics. Who's running for office, when they're running for office, and where. This training is very issues-focused, and it's very focused on not talking past one another, on having a dialogue in plain speech, right? And a dialogue about hard economics and hard outcomes. How do we actually go about creating an economy that works for people, right? And it's almost always shocking how much you'll find we're all almost in agreement on so many.
And the facts speak for themselves in this, too. You don't need talking points and persuasion when you just have hard numbers put in front of you showing you.
And history showing the success the ultra-rich have had in dividing us on these issues time and time again, and showing how when positive progress that stands out well as positive progress in our collective memories too, like the civil rights movement, populist movement, and the New Deal, how all these movements happened when people came together, right? And they realized, maybe for a brief period in time, maybe it was eventually shut down or they didn't win perfect change, but they realized that they could win real meaningful change if they got together and understood what they were capable of when we all realized that we kind of want the same thing.
And you talk a lot about silo busting, which we talk about here a lot too, which is why we bring in activists from so many different walks of life onto the show to try to get everybody in touch and build a community out of this. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about your program, is that you do try to community build so we can all fight together.
Yeah. And this is a great way to do it. I'm seeing more of it, a lot more of it from sort of, I think a lot of activists that felt splintered at the beginning of the decade, right? And maybe this is because I was young at the time, but I didn't feel people talking to one another, right? And then there's wonderful things like the show. And then, you know, I get to discover and work on this campaign with Les and with the Work Environment Council. And it seems like real positive change actually is on the horizon. As terrifying as that sounds with the man who we have in office right now, and everything you hear about, I think the grassroots movements are really...
Yeah, there's always hope, and there's always a light at the end of the tunnel.
I think we're putting in the
work.
We're
going to build it.
I think it's closer than we think it is. Yeah.
All right. Well, I wanted to thank you again for being here today. I hope everybody will reach out to you. I'll put those links in the show notes for everybody.
Thank you for having me, Heather.
If you like what you hear here on New Jersey Revolution Radio and want to support us as we bring to light amazing activists or news stories that you're not hearing everywhere else, please go to our website, NJ Revolution Radio, and click on the contribute or donate link. And, you know, no matter how much it is, even $5, help us keep this going so that we can keep bringing you the news that you want to hear. This is Heather Warburton saying, the future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.